We saw the emergence of ancient Israel arising as an alternative to a very well-established form of community, one that offered security to all members, even to slaves. But we found that Israel was drawn towards another ideal of community because of the promise that some ancient patriarchs and matriarchs had received from God. Just to review, and then we're going to have one of our class reflect a bit on, is Tom here today? Tom?
Here I am.
Okay, reflect a little on the drawing that we have up on the board here. By way of review, we saw that Israel was born through the Exodus, born out of experience as slaves within a well-secured society. Egypt was a well-secured society because it provided for the security of all of its members. And it did that. Let's see now. There is in the Decalogue a law against theft. Okay. I'm not saying it was you. No, it was I that moved over there in the discussion this morning. Well secured for a very specific reason. Ancient Egypt didn't exist for 2,500 years by accident. No. It provided for security by having an authority, a pharaoh, who established authority by admitting that he was God. And that allowed the entire populace to look up to this one with the assurance that what he said, what he decreed, what he established for the people was true, immutably, unchangingly true. So here you had the typical ancient Near Eastern society securing a stratified social structure on the basis of a religious authority. The pharaoh was God. That meant the entire religious institution of that time reified the authority of the pharaoh as God, as the chief boss of the society. So here we see security as the product of that kind of society. Now, we had, on the other hand, within this society, this little group of slaves, the Apiru, the Hebrews, who remembered that God had promised their ancestors not primarily security, but a movement towards a promise, a land, a progeny, a future, and an ability to be God's people as a free people, determining their own priorities and destiny. And so that's the lure of freedom. And it was that that empowered them to move from security into the great liminal stage of wilderness, that stage betwixt and between, where there wasn't everything answered by the chief honcho, and then on through the wilderness to a construction of an alternative community. Now that was one dedicated, fiercely, severely, to a preservation of freedom. There will be no slaves. We will not come under a pharaoh. But also the beginning of an ideology which would not allow this people to enslave others. You know, what good is it if you simply become slaveholders yourself? And we just glimpsed briefly at some of the texture that they began to create, to preserve that kind of equality and justice in their land. Let's read one law that they came up with, because I just quickly on the end paraphrased it, and then talk just for a minute about the economic structures that they established in the land, and then step back and reflect on this paradigm of tension between security and freedom before we introduce our shocking new topic today, namely, why Israel decided to go right back to slavery. So let's turn to Exodus. I've got two Bible studies, and I forget. Did we read out of the book of Exodus 20 to 22?
Yeah.
We did read some of those laws, so we've done more than I realized. And okay, now just to refresh our memory, did you hear? Refresh our memory. what was it that supplied Israel with the wherewithal to construct laws that would safeguard a just society? What did Israel draw on? Do you remember? In those motive clauses? Let's just remember one. You shall not oppress the sojourner or the alien. That's ger in Hebrew, alien. That's, I think, the best translation, since we deal with that problem today, don't we, in the sanctuary movement. You shall not oppress the alien, for you know the nefesh, the essential being, the soul of the alien. Why do you? Because you were aliens, right? You were aliens in Egypt. Now that's the source of Israel's fierce sense of justice as she tries to build up an alternative society. So the source, if you're going to locate it, would be in what within the community? Memory. Let's reflect on that for a minute. Okay, let's step back from Israel's own situation. What is the function of memory within our community life, as a nation or as a church? Is memory important?
It preserves things that were.
Okay.
Our sense of history.
Of
where we belong in our time.
Yeah, it gives that perspective of the ages. Where we were. Where we came from.
It creates our identity.
Yeah. I think that's very important. Our identity, in the case of Israel, is as former slaves, not as lords and ladies of the world, but as ones who started from nothing. This morning in the staff Bible study, someone was reflecting on how difficult it is to be born wealthy within this biblical faith that we're reading about. Rich people really have a terrible struggle. You know, the rich young ruler and the metaphor of the camel going through the eye of a needle and the song of Hannah that we'll come to today. Is it possible for one who is now secure in a land, a new land, an abundant land, to remain humane? Well, memory. Memory that none of this is substantial. None of this is earned by you. It's gift. That's what memory does. Now, you know, in our own situation, this country, we began with Robert Bellis reminding us that we're jeopardizing everything we hold dear by departing from our biblical and republican roots. Remember, again, that's not a party designation, but our republic, the roots of our republic. And when we think of folks like Jefferson, individualists who, however, dedicated their individualistic energies for the common weal. Okay, we're abandoning wholesale those biblical and republican roots and instead adopting a very self-centered individualism and materialism. How can memory help us? Keep us simple. Remind us of an earlier age. Remind us of our ancestors. Help us to set priorities. We can be reminded that in many, many ways, the quality of life of some of our ancestors who lived a more austere life was better than the quality of life that many of us lead amidst our plenty. Someone this morning mentioned Holden as a place of memory, where we are able to step back from the fast track. I think that's what we're calling it these days. It seems to be an appropriate metaphor. Maybe to extend the metaphor, you know, we get a flat, either through exhaustion or some of those crises of life that we mentioned yesterday, and we have to drive into the pit. Maybe Holden's our pit. And someone opens up the hood and looks at that engine and listens to it. And maybe that someone is ourselves and each other and maybe even God. We recollect things from our past that we've forgotten, memory. And I think it's terribly important. Well, we're going to look now back at the Bible, at Israel's sense of memory and the function of memory. That is really what motivated Israel saying, ah, yes, there is that person without a home, without citizen rights in our country. The normal thing to do in the ancient Near East in this system is plunk right into the category designed for you. It's perfect. It's called slavery. You become a commodity and a productive part of the economy by sacrificing your human dignity. That's what you do with the person that crosses the border. It's a well-lubricated, good social system because its social structure is drawn into its economic interests. That's what would have happened over here. Now, Israel has this alien. The question mark can serve for the alien, so we don't need to waste ink. What do you do with the alien in this society? On all sides, the rule is there. Utilize that alien. That alien will work for cheap wages because if it complains or strikes or anything, it draws attention to, let's say, herself, so we don't speak in terms of it in relation to people, draws attention to herself, and the authorities will be there. You know how these aliens now, even with the new laws that allow them to enter a process of naturalization, how scared they are. This is a vulnerable class. And the temptation is to exploit them. Israel says, no. Remember, every one of us were aliens. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you as a child of an immigrant. It means that you essentially, because your ancestors came from slavery, were all aliens. That's where you came from. That's the function of memory. It gives us our identity. Has that been lost in our country? We are all aliens. I don't think there's a single Native American here. We all came from somewhere else. We don't deserve this country. We don't deserve, we haven't earned our affluence and our wealth. We remember who we are, and then we see this person that is fresh across the border. And can we draw that person into an oppressive economic structure? Not if we remember who we are by remembering where we came from. That's the function of memory in Israel. And it was reinforced by remembering that we came from where we were, slavery, to where we are, free persons, because God does not tolerate the enslavement of other human beings. That's the fierce enforcement of that memory, the nature of God, which is ultimately the source of this alternative community. Now, Tom looked at this thing and he had a couple of responses. Tom, you've got 3 minutes on my watch to come up here and reflect out loud on what you saw in this quadrangle under security and this circle under freedom over here.
You can be thinking what you're going to do with the extra 2 minutes that I'm not going to use.
Okay.
This was simply an afterthought after being energized, as I'm sure we all are, during and after these sessions. And I was asked to carry this over to the next day, which is awfully hard for me. But at the time it occurred that this particular form doesn't travel well. That's okay for stasis, for remaining in place. But how do you pick that up and go with it?
You don't roll it either.
No, that's not a roller. This is a travel design. Maybe that's when they invented the wheel. We're not certain. But this is when we're in motion, when we're on pilgrimage, when we're out wayfaring. And this, as bad as it is, has quite an attraction for us. It's all indicated, it's in our corporate memories. Some of the slaves didn't want to leave the plantations when they were set free. That's a fact. And that's more recent memory. But there's always a tendency to want to go back because, you know, wilderness. There's a lot of talk these days about there's a magazine by the name of Wilderness, and it's a wilderness experience. And some folks are just so much in love with wilderness that they bring their Winnebagoes. And isn't that really where we are. We want to take the good part of this out here. And there are always folks who are very happy to accommodate us. I'm a Catholic, and I've got a guy back in Rome, his name is Cardinal Ratzinger. And he would just love to undo Vatican II and all that has set a lot of us free and put this out there in the desert and start again and get us all numbered and lined up. And all churches have these friends who are anxious to get us all organized and all lumped together, and we sure know who's on top, don't we? And so I think it's understandable. And I think wilderness is scary, because wilderness really means that we're lost and we're taking on faith. Yeah, I think this is where we took the turn. I think this is where we're supposed to do this or do that, but you're not quite sure. And we really are operating in a wilderness. That's what our life is now. And I know that we all of us are going to be tempted to go back to some kind of structured system where there's a place for everything and everything will be in its place. But I think we have to give each other the ongoing courage every day. Keep moving. And this is the form. And it doesn't take a Winnebago. We all have to learn to travel light. I know that when we pack to come to Holden, we're guilty of exactly that. We're prepared for just about any emergency. I'm sure won't come up. We carry about 3 times more than we could possibly use. And so, you know, I'm like all good little sermons, they're preached to oneself. This is what I need to learn. So thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Well, that traveling light, I suspect, necessitates that memory include the memory of brokenness as we define it as openness. The temptation, as we'll see now, as we enter the period of kingship, is exactly what you said for Israel to bring the Winnebago into this new land. That is to say, to provide for security. So there is no brokenness and openness anymore. Everything is established and set for all time. Well, what's that do? If you establish your society, define it hierarchically so as to provide for your security for all time, what's that do? That kind of self-definition. Pardon me?
It's rigid, it's not adaptable.
Okay. Now, what's it do to this person who happened to wander through your border?
It closes them up.
Closes down the system. And I think that psychologically that's true. You know, the mind that finally has it all set. God in a box. No one's going to ever add anything to this person's understanding of the divine mystery. And certainly no one's going to lead that person to understanding more about the human mystery. It's all set. That's not the wilderness experience. That's the sedentary experience. Travel light, remain open, keep your tent flap open to visitors who may happen through. I think that's early Israel. Now, we've spent a fair amount of time on that because I think it is, in a sense, a paradigm of what it means to be a person of faith. You find people who are struggling under oppressors harking back repeatedly to the Exodus as a source of hope. I think that we can see why it's such a powerful source of hope if we remember the three ingredients of that new alternative concept of community. It was a community acknowledging only one authority, and that was God, a divine authority. That meant that no human power could say, I am king, I have the right to tell you what you are to do. It meant that within Israel, social classes, from the divine king to the priests who have all the religious answers, to the nobility who own all the land, and then on down, that simply was not possible. There was only one authority, and that was God, and each human had equal access to that authority. Secondly, this authority demonstrated power not in driving people into subservience, but in empowering those who were impoverished. That means that in deriving Israel's quality of life from the nature of that sovereign, Israel came to embody the qualities of righteousness, that is to say, equal justice deserved by all, indeed owed to all in the society, and finally compassion, a reaching out to embrace specifically those that can't make it against the standard of righteousness, a remaining restless until all God's family is united in this context of shalom, of well-being for all. Now that's a pretty lofty ideal. That's a pretty lofty ideal. I added that I would only mention one word about economic structure. How are you going to deal with land? Land is power. We know what happens in real estate in this country. My God, inequities seem to occur on the basis of manipulation of land more than anything else. What happens when an individual no longer has a piece of land? That person is a victim, is really vulnerable to the control of others. Eviction, if you can get more rent. Eliminate the rental units if you can turn them into condos and sell them. And we have an increasing impoverished and disempowered class in our society because of our concept of land. Well, Israel did that, dealt with that in an astonishing manner by saying, we have one King Yahweh, and that means only one landowner. You see, to get land ownership out of the hands of unpredictable human beings. And so each family will receive a nechalah. Isn't that a pretty word? A nechalah. A nechalah. A piece of land. And that is not property of that family. It's a sacred trust. God owns it. But the fact that God owns it and it's a sacred trust means that it can never be lost by that family. It can only be handed down. And so that assured the security of every family. So we saw laws forbidding usury and forbidding the taking of security that'll jeopardize the well-being, even that might cause a person to shiver at night. God hears that. That's how particular this concern is in this society. And then this dividing of the land up equally. Now, is human history a pattern of inexorable rectilineal improvement? Have we surpassed that, you know, by about 3,000 years? Let's look at the Song of Hannah in 1 Samuel 2. 1 Samuel 2. Hannah is a wonderful spokesperson for this ideal. She knows whereof she spoke. She lives now towards the end of the period of the League, the one we're talking about before kings came on the scene. And she already sees developments towards security, towards reimposing the hierarchy and inequality. She can understand that and be very alarmed about it because she, by virtue of her being a woman in that society, knows what oppression is. You know, whatever else you can say about early Israel, it had not broken the bond of sexism. It had troubles with it, but it embedded into those same humane laws that we saw in Exodus 20 to 23, a law releasing male slaves in the seventh year, but not female slaves. Noting that they're property of their masters. And the master, if he's tired of them, and that means probably tired of them as sexual property, can dismiss them. I say, however, that created a great conflict with Israel because there was that motivating sense of community resting in God, who was just, who treated people equally. And so that dynamic sense created a great conflict between the oppressive laws of that early period and this humane example of God, the compassionate, righteous one. So when Israel rewrote that law of slaves in Deuteronomy around the year 750, the discrimination was eliminated. And in Deuteronomy, male and female slaves are released.
In Leviticus, which was written around 570, slavery, enslavement of the Hebrew was eliminated entirely. And so you can see how that dynamic works constantly through memory. Even in Leviticus, that latest codification of the law, the motive clause was, for you were slaves in Egypt. Huh? That's why you are not to enslave anyone in your land. Now Hannah, though, was at this early stage one who felt the contradiction in her own person. Here were these humane laws protecting everyone, but still discriminating bitterly against the woman. How did she know? There is a wonderful, vivid little vignette that tells us how she knew. Hannah was a victim of oppression. Now, her husband, Ahimelech, was not an inhumane person. He was tender and caring for her. You see, she had a deep sorrow. She could not bear children. The other wife, the rival wife, Peninnah, had children and would taunt her. So she was bitterly sorrowful. In that society, you know, children were much more than now. They were your only security if you were a woman. Without them, you would probably suffer deprivation in old age. So she went into the sanctuary, the temple of the Lord, and she poured out her heart to the Lord. Now Eli comes. He's the priest. So you already have this kind of stratification occurring. You've got the religious experts who transmit what it's right to believe. And so here's the woman, deprived of power, and the authoritative male. And here she is, genuinely pouring her heart out to Yahweh. Well, there's also something about the male spirit that doesn't like female tears. I don't know if any of you males have experienced that, but they're too honest, and they sometimes cut too deeply to the issues that count. So you'd like to eliminate the tears. And that's what Eli said. He said, "Woman, you have drunk too much out of the sanctuary of the Lord." But she hung in there, she persisted, and went away with a blessing. And she received a child. And she dedicated that child to the Lord, and out of the fullness of her heart, she rejoiced in God's empowerment of the lowly. And let's read that. Let's begin right here. 1 Samuel 8, verse 1. And we will continue around this crescent here. We'll see if we make it to John. I doubt it, because we have only 10 verses. Okay. 1 Samuel 8. Now, do recall as well that this is not just sort of one little Old Testament hymn stuck in the mouth of some woman in that ancient period. When 1 Samuel 2. Yeah, 1 Samuel 2. I'm sorry. Did I say 2 Samuel 1? It's 1 Samuel 2. Yeah. Thank you, Bob. 1 Samuel 2. No, this became a hymn that Luke recalled as sung by Mary when she received a similar gift of God's Spirit. So it is tremendously central to the gospel message. And let's see what kind of a message it is. Okay, what is your name?
John.
Well, John's going to begin, and we'll go towards John at least.
Hannah also prayed and said, "My heart exalts in the Lord. My strength is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies, because I rejoice in thy salvation."
There is none holy like the Lord. There is none besides thee. There is no rock like our God.
Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed.
The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble gird on strength.
Those who were full have hired himself out for bread, and those who were hungry have seized with hunger. The barren is born seven, but she who had many children forlorn.
The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down the shell and raises up.
The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low, he also exalts.
He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes and has them inherit the throne of honor. The foundations of the earth are the Lord's. Upon them he has set the world.
He will guard the feet of his saints, but the wicked will be silenced in darkness.
It is not by strength that one prevails.
The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the power of his anointed.
Now, you may feel like you've stumbled over a stone when you read that last half verse. Well, we'll comment on that shortly. But the rest of the song of Hannah, what ideal of community is she celebrating? Yeah. Okay, the lowly shall be raised up. Anyone else have a reaction to this song? What view of society do you have here? It is an inversion, isn't it? It's a turning of tables. Things are flipped upside down. Some call that revolution. It is a revolution. And who sponsors this revolution? God. Now, there's a serious question. This is scripture. To what sort of situation does this apply? Now, if we were going to talk biblical methodology, I would strenuously oppose someone arguing that, well, here's the verse, this is God's will. Every passage has to be contextualized, understood in its own setting, and then one has to utilize that in shedding light on our contemporary setting by seeing where that text fits in overall scripture. But I can just share my own conclusion that this Song of Hannah summarizes Israel's early of communal justice. And it is so central to the biblical theme that it was placed at the heart of the Gospels. This is really what God is about in the world. And let's see where God is. Just sociologically, you can read this. This song identifies God with which categories of people? Can you just scan it and go down and name some of them?
The needy.
The needy. What others?
Feeble.
The feeble. The poor. The hungry.
The childless.
Okay, then there's that other side. Let's read the other side. There's a side that is being opposed or is being deposed or depotentized by God. Let's read some of those categories.
Wicked.
The wicked.
Proud.
The proud.
Princes.
Nobles.
Adversaries
of the Lord, the arrogant,
the soldiers,
and the mighty. Well, you know, those are stark oppositions, aren't they? What do you think we do with them? How do we understand God in relation to powers and to disempowered people and groups today? What's the message of this text? Yes, I heard a voice.
Well, I was just going to say today it seems like our society has turned this around.
Yeah.
The powerful are the ones that are favored by God.
Yeah.
And we tend to think our nation, the most powerful on earth, is
yes, indeed.
The one that God has.
Yep. So we've uncritically accepted that definition of power. And again, if we try to label it, you know, to try to get some conceptual handles on it, it seems to me that the way we've appropriated structures of power is under the category of the power of the privileged. We have a concept that some people are privileged, that have special privilege. And that of necessity implies the disenfranchisement and disempowerment of others. The impoverishment, let's face it. If you have people that deserve special privilege in the world, it of necessity implies the impoverishment of others. So as you were saying, we've adopted a vision of society which is the reverse of this, that assumes those in positions of power and assumes those in positions of impoverishment, but identifies God with the opposite side, with the side of the empowered. I think that has to really shake us up. you know, as Tom said, the message is directed at oneself first. So I can only say that very meekly, and I think out of brokenness. I think the message is simply there, that God, as early Israel understood God, was squarely on the side of those that had suffered under systems demanding special privilege for the few. I think it's inevitable that we have to understand this message now after we see the whole development of this theme into a universal theme in the Bible within the global community. We cannot just simply apply this to this society. The conclusions would be radical even within our own country, the United States of America, and we see what incredible disjunctures there are in distribution of power and well-being, commonweal. But if you put it in a global setting, it's the implications are truly shocking. And what more can we say except to take it to heart? No, it isn't. It's difficult for us to conceptualize. And that because, again, the other ideology, you know, this one here, is so much, it's just a part of our thinking. And there's good reason. We have a whole system of indoctrination, of propagandizing in this country, that reinforces that, that says that, you know, what some folks are doing here, you know, really living on the poverty line, for reasons of taxation and other reasons, that's ridiculous. Where I teach, the whole ethos is just shockingly materialistic. It's get ahead, you know, this Wall Street insider trading scandal is no accident. That's produced by our business school. You know, so who's the chairman of the Wall Street stock market, which is New York Stock Exchange, Securities Commission. He has contributed $30 million to Harvard Business School for chairs in business ethics. Well, I mean, for good reason. He sees where this insider trading business is coming from. It's coming from a dominant cultural ethos that it's all right for those with much to keep on grabbing more and more and more. Now think of the whole nature of our industrial complex in this country, advertising. You know, it's predicated on a certain philosophy of advertising to create need. And more need, and more need. Now, I'd be stupid. Maybe I'm stupid going as far as I did in entering into complex issues like economics. I'd be stupid to claim that we can just simply dismantle this and have prosperity for everybody. We'd have unemployment and, you know, terrible social disjuncture. But what I'm suggesting is that our whole system is built on what the Exodus story has confronted as ungodly and unjust. Our whole system is built on it. Well, thank God for places like this, where at least we can try to exercise another chamber of our brain to see if there is a more faithful way. And, you know, I think that there are incremental steps that can be taken. I think tax structure can be looked at. And I think the whole advertising industry and the whole entertainment industry can be confronted. You know, what our kids are taught to hear as romantic and good and the normal thing, that's life destructive, that stuff. Now I'm beginning to sound like I'm moral majority or something. Well, since it's neither moral nor majority, as they say, maybe we should claim that title and start speaking out in the name of an alternative vision of community. Well, let's take the next step. You know, we can just tantalize ourselves as we walk through the Bible. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 8 now. You know, after that marvelous outpouring of Hannah, well, we already had a little echo of warning on the end of that song. I think that the royal scribes, in integrating this song into the Deuteronomistic history, which was written in the court of Josiah, added the last half verse. Because after she said all this about taking princes down from their thrones, it ends with, "The Lord will give strength to the king and exalt the power of his anointed." I don't know. But I suspect that, you know, in the growth of tradition, that now has been drawn into the royal system, because that's the next step. And we get it in 1 Samuel 8. Samuel's old. His sons aren't doing too good, as they say these days. My kids would correct me since I corrected them. Not doing too well, Daddy. Yeah.
Your last comment on the king, would it not depend on whom you designate as king?
That's a very...
Of Melchizedek, the king to God Most High, who Abram encountered in the Promised Land.
Yeah.
Then that's an altogether different perspective.
We don't know much about Melchizedek, because he was not even a king of Yahweh. He was a king of the Canaanite god in Jebus. But we do have David, who God promised to be like the king, a king after the order of Melchizedek, which means that he would be a priest king, that he would unite titles of chief religious leader and civil leader in the country. That's what that means.
That is the way I understood Melchizedek, because some word refers to him in Hebrews as one without beginning and without end.
Right. And in Genesis 14, Psalm 110, and the book of Hebrews gives you the whole history of Melchizedek. That, if I could rephrase that, that could that reference to the king refer to Hezekiah or Josiah? And I think that's what the writer had in mind, one who would unify these early radical ideals of the early Augustic period with the ideal of kingship. In other words, can't you have the just king? A king who is one who protects the poor and the like. And I think the answer is yes, and we'll come to that. In fact, in my little book, The Diversity of Scripture, I argue that we have royal traditions and prophetic traditions. The royal, we'll see what they are. The prophetic continuing this radical ideology. We have them alongside of each other because there is need in life for form, that which structures and holds together, and reform, that which tears apart in the name of justice. You can't have a just society without both. And again, I hear you asking that. Is it not possible that that verse there is the reminder that you need both? I think that's a very real possibility. Thank you for that comment. Now, though, before we get too kind with kings, we're going to hear what earliest tradition said about kings and what it meant. So here they come to Samuel and say, okay, can't we have a king? And Samuel, first of all, thinks that's threatening his office. Isn't it enough that I be your leader? And he complains to God about it, and God says, never mind, give him a king, because they are not, and this is verse 7 of 1 Samuel 8, Lord said, hearken to the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. What's going on here? God says that this is a case of apostasy. According to all the deeds which they have done to me from the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day forsaking me and serving other gods, so are they doing also to you. Now then hearken to their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. Asking for a king is removing me from being king and taking this kind of king and putting it over them. That's what Samuel seems to be saying. And now let's take it one step forward. The Lord gives Samuel a message to bring to the people. And what he says is, tell them what the ways of the king will be. The word is mishpatim, the plural, statutes, laws, is what's used when God gives the people commandments and ordinances. Except now, what Samuel is saying, you shall tell them that they're not going to have God's ordinances, but the king's ordinances is what will guide them. Warn them about the ways of the king, the Mishpatei HaMelech, the ordinance of the king. Now let's read what those warnings include. This is what kingship will be like. Let's start with you, John, this time. And let us read 1 Samuel 8, verses 10 through 18.
So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the prophets who were asking a king for him.
He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots.
And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots.
He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers.
He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain of your vineyard and give it to his officers and to his servants.
Your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take the tenth of your flocks and you yourselves will become his slaves.
You will shed bitter tears because of this king you are demanding, but the Lord will not help you."
Okay, now we have an interesting thing here. What is that translation that you have there? The Living Bible. Now, since we read in Exodus 6 from the Revised Standard Version, I'm going to reread that verse because the same Hebrew phrase comes in both Exodus 6 and in 1 Samuel 8. And we don't hear that if we have two different translations. So it reads in the RSV, "And in that day you will cry out because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you on that day." We can begin with that. What's that alluding to? Remember where the Exodus began?
When the people cried out.
When the people cried out. And what happened in that day? The Lord heard them. Okay, so that's self-conscious, isn't it? That's an inclusio. That is pointing back to Israel's starting point. Well, why won't God hear them? Yeah. John?
Well, at Sinai, they ratified the covenant that God would rule.
Yeah.
And now they're going to choose another one.
Yeah.
So the theocracy comes to an end.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so, you know, here God once heard their cry and got them out of the soup, right? And led them over here and in that new freedom allowed them to evolve a humane way of structuring community. And they're no sooner there, then they say, "No, we don't want it. We want to get back into this situation." And Samuel says, now this is rhetorical, and this is very prophetic, and this material was transmitted by prophetic circles. That's why we have it in our Bible today. So the prophets are saying, go ahead and do that. You know, just go and get yourself a king again and get this kind of a society started up again. And what's the bottom line? You will become his slaves. Plunk, you're going to end up right there again. You're going to have security, and you're going to have slavery. And then in that day, in your slavery, you're going to cry to Yahweh, what's going to happen? You can't expect Yahweh to keep getting you out of the soup if you keep putting yourself in it by virtue of your free election of that form of government. You've deserved it well. Well, that may sound kind of vindictive. And you know, you got the problem that Luther addressed of the left hand of God, the God who spanks and slaps and, you know, punishes. But what is that? Is that just sort of a vindictiveness of an angry God? What is it, Mike? You're shaking your head.
It's love.
Oh, how can that be love? You must be a parent or something.
I'm not a parent. My wife's saying teaching. I'm thinking it's traditional.
Yeah.
It's like, how else do the children of Israel learn but from their mistakes, and a loving God will always bail them out.
Exactly. I mean, what happens if you have that kind of permissiveness in a classroom, in a family? Well, that's all right, sweetie. Mommy will get you out of that one. What happens? Irresponsible children, Mike. Gosh, I mean, they don't know love. You're right. Can't know love without knowing a moral structure of the universe. And so this God who says you can't just go on sinning with impunity as a bunch of stupid people that can't recognize shalom and expect me to simply bail you out, to do that would be to destroy the moral fabric of the universe. There has to be punishment where there's crime. That's a word of mercy. It's severe mercy, but without it you don't have mercy and you don't have compassion. So that's a pretty tough warning. the structure of society that is implicit in the Mishpatei HaMelech, the ways of the king. What is that structure? Pardon me? It's hierarchical. It's stratified. It's a system of privilege. Everything filters up, right? And very little filters down. The whole economy, you know, and that's what we're talking about when he'll get the best of your land, the tenth of this and that and this and the other thing. We call that tithing. In ancient Israel, that was the sacrificial system, which was a form of taxation. Remember, David decided that he wanted to redivide the land. Remember that? In the end of 1 Samuel, read, just cut up the land a little bit. End of 1 Samuel. Redivide the land. Take a census. And a plague hit the land. God sent that plague. What's wrong with counting your subjects? Why did God get so ticked off with David? What was David doing there?
Building his tax structure.
That's exactly right. And he re-carved up the tribal, you know, these old tribal allotments that were kind of willy-nilly, you know, this people settled there and that there. And they really liked those. I mean, that was their nechalah. This just encompassed the nechalot of the bigger family, the tribe. And David said, this place is too big and this has all the grain and I can't have 12 equal tax districts that way. I'm going to count the people and redivide the land. So, well, you know, he backed off, but then Solomon did it, and Solomon built a temple, which in the ancient Near East was a granary. It was where all the produce of the country came for redistribution. Redistribution determined by whom? By Chief Honcho, the king. So you can see how this system is being reimposed, and the prophet says, well, that's maybe what you will elect, but watch out. You're going to end up right where you started. Bottom line, and you shall be his slaves. Now, why did they do that? I'm going to suggest one more verse. I should check the time here so we don't keep you forever. I think we can bring it to a conclusion in 5 minutes. One more verse. Would someone read the people's response? This is a good warning, right? They shouldn't be too eager to become slaves. Their reply comes in chapter 8 still, verse 19 and 20. Go ahead. First person finds it, reads it. Sure, both of you read it. Go ahead. That might be interesting. Go ahead.
But the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles.
Okay, fine. Now, I like the structure of Hebrew syntax. You know, in the case of the laws, it says you shall do this or that or shall not do this or that because you were slaves in Egypt, God led you out. You know, motive clauses. Now, here the people come to their conclusion. They're going to repudiate all these warnings. No, we want a king. And then they say why. Now, remember those earlier laws were predicated on remembering how God was a gracious deliverer. Now, that's how they ended up with this society. That was their motivation, to embody the qualities of the gracious, just deliverer. Now we find that they want a king, they want to go back here. It's interesting to check their motives, right? What are their motives in the syntax of that Hebrew sentence?
We want to be like the
others. We want to be like the other nations. Okay, there you are. That's what the other nations are like. And why do you want a king explicitly up there? All right. King will go, look at even the preposition, go before us. Now, what form of society is that? You have one who will go before you. Authoritarianism, right? Dictatorship, kingship. Well, it's a model where someone will make the decisions and do the work for you. In return for what? Security and a loss of freedom. So there we are. It's an incredible reversal that we find occurring in Israel. Remember, that's prophetic tradition saying this, handing this material on. Well, remember what the prophets had to fight against. Remember Hosea, Amos, how they had to battle against what? Two things, basically. A theological problem and a social problem. Other gods. a redividing up of the heavens into all these gods. This one takes care of fertility, that's Baal. This one, Yahweh, takes care of history, etc. So life gets scattered. Social problem, injustice in all of its sordid forms. You invite a king back, that's what you're going to get. Now, okay, the prophets say, watch out, okay, but you did it. Should they then conclude, okay, if that's what you choose, to hell with you? You think that's what prophetic tradition decided? No? What do you think the prophets decided to do with kingship? Two answers. We have one down here and then up in the balcony. Okay, a voice down here.
Yes, the prophet was the conscience, really, and as working for God, too.
Yeah, very good. Let's record that remark first. Conscience for God. Earlier in this situation here, we really didn't describe the form of government there, but it was really simple. We have the people, in Hebrew, Am. They're in their family groupings, of course, but in terms of the people as a whole, they are one people without differentiation. And as far as leadership is concerned, well, we had Yahweh as the only king. But Yahweh's rule, John used the word, theocracy, Yahweh's rule was realized within the crises of the people in the form of the judge. The Hebrew word is shofet, it's better translated, deliverer, the one that God designated and empowered in a time of crisis. But that was just Joe or Mary, who came out of the field, empowered with God, like Deborah and Yael, to take care of that crisis, then they returned to their modest place in the society. There was no dynastic succession, there was no special privilege there. Now that was that form of government. Now we get a king. Okay, and that's a different story, because kings will succeed each other. You have special privilege and protection. Read Psalm 89. God promises dynastic succession forever to the king. That's a real different system. And we see here in 1 Samuel 8 that threatens something that Israel held very dear on the example of the God of equal justice. So let's sketch that form of government. Earlier we had the shofet, the judge, charismatically designated, simply doing God's will. Now we have evolving the king, Melech in Hebrew and in other Semitic languages. It's a common institution throughout the ancient Near East. The king, who does have an established position. He doesn't just go back into the body politic when the crisis is over. He stays. And it's institutionalized power. Now, what is your name? Irene suggested that prophetic faith arose, and now I'll just say arose, at coeval with the introduction of kingship, to preserve the shofet element, that will of God in the midst of the people that cannot be institutionalized, cannot be co-opted. We'll see how kings tried to co-opt the religious structure, the cult, the religious institutions. Look at when Amos tries to talk in God's sanctuary in Bethel, Amaziah, the priest, says, get out of here. This is the king's sanctuary. The land can't hear your words, O prophet. The religious system becomes an extension of the royal power, exactly as in Egypt. That's what some kings tried to do. The temple is a chapel of the king, national religion. Prophecy arose to preserve the autonomy of God's voice that could not be co-opted in the land. Okay, now, so we're going to expect inevitably in the next chapter we turn to when we look at Hosea, expect a tremendous struggle between prophets trying to keep alive that sense of equal justice under God's reign and kings who will continually be tempted to bring power under their own control. Now, the question we end with, what will prophets do with this new situation? They could condemn kingship. They could ignore kingship. They could embrace kingship and become great champions. Some of them did. The 200 or 400, I forget, prophets of Jehoshaphat, of Ahab, did that. Those are all alternatives. No, they took a very subtle other road. And I'm going to read just a few more verses to introduce us to next tomorrow's topic. This is in 1 Samuel 12. In fact, I won't read it. Would someone please read in closing 1 Samuel 12, 19 to 25? Okay, what path did prophecy take vis-a-vis kingship? It's a dual path. It's a subtle path. You know, we're going to have to take just a minute to work this out, and then I promise we will quit and have coffee. That's easy for me to say as I'm still holding my cold coffee, right? And you're all okay. What's the dual path? Does it embrace kingship?
No.
What's it called, kingship?
Adversarial process.
Yeah. Okay. Kingship, in a word here, it's a product of sin, right? There's no denying that. The people confess it, and Samuel says, sure, you have adopted kingship as an act of betrayal. So they could go on and just condemn kingship, but there's a real big but there. What's the prophet say? But?
But you must fear the Lord.
Yeah, but that's too quick. There's something in between. You must fear the Lord, but what's it say about kingship? Yahweh will not give up the people, right? The prophet will continue to pray for the people. This is an act of apostasy, this kingship. It's an act of sin. You know, you've got a government because you're sinful and you're disobedient. But nevertheless, God will continue to work within this structure of sin. If only you do not worship that product of sin. If only it doesn't become your ultimate loyalty. Your ultimate loyalty remains the old one, God. Follow God, be obedient to God's will, and you will live. Abandon God and God's will, and you and your king will be consumed, destroyed. Now, I would call that prophetic realism.